Welcome to the sermon podcast of South Hills Church in Costa Mesa. My name is Chris Kretzu, and I'm the campus pastor here. Thank you for carving out the time to listen to this today. I hope that you will be encouraged and challenged, and ultimately that you'll have a deeper sense of God's love for you. I'll be back after the message is over, but until then, I hope that you enjoy this episode. So we are in this series, Political Powder Keg. We started it last week, and we're talking about politics. And in this series, our assumption and really our hope and our goal is to make all of us a little bit uncomfortable. We're turning up the heat. Get it? There's no AC. Okay. We want us all to be a little bit uncomfortable because it's really easy for us to just only see things the way that we've always seen things and only think about things the way we've always thought about them. Our brains want to do as little work as possible. There is a more beautiful scientific way to explain that truth. And so it's really difficult for us to actually get out of the rut or the norm of how we think. And so our goal is to make us a bit uncomfortable, to see things a little bit differently in the hopes that God will help us become stronger, more loving, more kind, more whole as his children and as humans. It feels like the air conditioning is on now, right? Yeah. Oh, God. I didn't even pray that you would fix the air conditioning, but what a gift. So we're going to be talking about this for the next few weeks, and we're continuing that today. And again, I just want to say that if you missed last week, I would love for you to go check it out. I do think these weeks kind of build on each other in a certain way. But we said last week that this isn't a series about getting you to vote a certain way. Really what we're talking about is how we relate, how we connect, how we care for and love well the people around us. How do we navigate the political realities of our country, of our state, of our cities, and also love people the way that God has called us to love them? A number of years ago, my son was upset because, he came up and he was pretty emotional, and he said, nobody wants to play with him. His friend didn't want to play with him, and he was really devastated by it, and he had kind of been on this kick for a little while about how nobody wanted to play with him. He didn't feel like he had any friends, and so me being the incredibly loving, generous father that I am, just kidding, but this time I did get it right. I got down on the floor, and I was like, I'll play with you, bud, and so we were playing with little action figures and Lego characters and all this stuff, and so, you know, doing my best, and I'm like, oh, we're walking, and I'm using voices and doing the whole thing, and everything that I did with the toy, he said, no, that's not where they go. They go here. I'm like, okay, and so I put them there, and then I would start talking. He's like, oh, that's not what they say. They say this. And everything that I did was not exactly what he wanted me to do. They weren't in the right place. They weren't saying the right things. And after about 5 minutes, I was very frustrated but committed to being a loving, patient father. And he picked up his toys and walked away and went to his mom and said, nobody wants to play with me. And it's like, well, okay, I'm starting to learn. Like, it's not that nobody wants to play with you, but you have a very limited, very specific way that you need people to play with you. It's really less about some sort of interaction and more about your requirement of others to actually show up. And so we talked about it, and I think he's gotten a little bit better at that. But the sad reality is that for many of us adults, too many of us adults, we act the same. There's this phrase that's been used for a long time. You know, I'm going to take my toys and I'm going to go to a different sandbox. You know, this idea of like, well, if, you know, I don't get what I want here, then I'm going to go somewhere else. And we have these expectations that people need to talk a certain way or do things a certain way, that there's no differences allowed. And when it becomes apparent, we start to get really upset. And we're a tribal people. We like to be around people who are like us, that think like us, that act like us. This has carried over so much into politics as well. Study after study shows that people's political opinions are becoming more and more a primary identity marker. And they're actually finding that political opinions and perspectives, political leanings, are actually formed at a much younger age, even than oftentimes people's spiritual lives. And so they very much are actually, their faith is literally being shaped by long-held political beliefs rather than how do we look at our politics through our faith. We're looking at our faith through our politics. This is becoming more and more of an issue. And the sad reality is that many people are taking their toys and walking away from friends, from family members, from neighbors, and just cutting off relationships. And I think what's really devastating is that this is also happening in the church, in churches all over the place. People would rather leave their church family in order to be closer to their political family. They'll find a different church that fits with their political leanings rather than A, be around people that are different, or B, ask the question, well, I wonder if any of my political beliefs need to change. I wonder if there's anything that should be adjusted in how I act and how I speak and how I approach and how I engage with others. And it's not just a distant thing. It's happened here. We've not even been a church for 7 years. And I have people that have been friends of mine that have left because of political differences, because we wouldn't say enough, or we said too much, or whatever it might be. And it's heartbreaking to see this happening. And last week, we talked about this idea of which kingdom do we want to operate in. Today, what I really want to talk about is how do we interact with other Christians? And if you're not a Christian here, there's going to be some really practical things that are still going to be helpful to you. But also, if you're not a Christian here, I hope that you are able to see kind of the core of what we're called to in our relationships with each other, and you're able to get a more beautiful picture than maybe what you've experienced in your past. And hopefully it's a picture that we as a church continue to move closer and closer to. But the reality is that there is just so much separation, and it's being driven by fear. Fear is the primary tool and the primary fuel that is used in politics. I saw a couple of different articles about this. There's one in the American Psychological Association. They said that fear-based messaging in politics is twice as effective as messaging that doesn't employ fear. It is twice as effective. And so if you want to win an election, if you want to get donations so that you can continue in your political goals or whatever it is, as noble as they might be, what we're seeing more and more and more is people are using fear because you don't want this to happen, do you? So then come here. You don't want this person or this party or this group to be in charge, do you? So then if we allow this to happen, how many of these commercials and emails and ads have you seen? It's the end of the world if this thing happens. I mean, it comes down to fear so much because it works. Last week, we talked about how over 50% of people in both primary political parties, Republican and Democratic political parties, they actually hate the other party more than they love their own. The reason why they're in their party is because of their anger at the other. They're afraid, they're upset, they're bothered with what they're doing, and so that is what's driving them to make the decisions that they're making. There's a speaker and writer named Sherry Harder, and she said this, which is, I think, such a powerful statement. She said, "Dwelling on fear and outrage is spiritually deforming." Dwelling on fear and outrage is spiritually deforming. And if you were to think about who you are spiritually, the spiritual health that you have, what is it that we believe on a very basic level? We serve a loving God. God is good. God is in control. We serve a God who's aware of our needs. We serve a God who wants to see goodness and mercy be spread. We believe these things to be true spiritually. But when we start to allow fear to get into our hearts and our minds, it's like, well, is he really good? Does he actually see? Maybe I actually need to rely on these people or this policy because I don't know if God's actually going to do something. And so there's this piece where it starts actually deforming us spiritually. What we believe starts to be eroded because of fear. We begin to put our faith in people or parties or platforms so that they can protect us from whatever it is that we're afraid of, including other people, people in our churches. It's more comfortable, it's more common for us to be comfortable around people that align with our political beliefs than it is with people who we share the same spiritual beliefs with. It's becoming more and more common. And I think that we're afraid of losing control. We're afraid of losing power. We're afraid of losing strength or wealth. We're afraid of losing the progress that we've made. We're afraid of losing culture. We're afraid of losing our freedom. And if we're not careful, we will buy into this message of fear. And ultimately, we'll begin to act on it. And this matters because Christians, Jesus followers, have begun to view, talk about, speak about other Christians in just some of the most brutal ways, just absolutely tearing people apart because of political topics. And we shouldn't be doing this with anybody. But it's interesting to me because Jesus had a very specific prayer. And this is one of the last prayers that he prayed in his life. And I want to look at it today. He was aware of the danger of division and the destruction that would come with it. And in John chapter 17, it's a long passage. And it's mostly just Jesus praying, which is kind of interesting. I grew up in youth group, and they would always ask, like, does anybody have any prayer requests? And so when you think about Jesus, the Son of God, with this prayer request, this is what he's choosing to pray with some of the last time that he has. And I'm going to skip around a little bit, but we'll have these verses on the screen. It starts off in verse 1. It says, after Jesus said this, he looked towards heaven and prayed, Father, the hour has come. Glorify your Son, that your Son may glorify you. And I just want to point out, when he says glorify your Son, this is not the shiny army, military victory, him on a podium. The moment when Jesus was most glorified was on the cross, when he was willingly giving his life for us to be able to heal the divide between us. In verse 11, it continues. It says, I will remain in the world no longer, but they, talking about the disciples, are still in the world, and I'm coming to you. Holy Father, protect them by the power of your name, the name that you gave me, so that they may be what? One, as we are one. You guys can talk without moving your bodies. It's okay. We can make this happen. So we can stay cool. Verse 20, it continues. Jesus says, my prayer is not for them alone. Them is the disciples that are there with him. It's not for them alone. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I'm in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. Jesus goes from praying for the disciples to then saying, I want to pray for all of the people who will believe through their message. So he's talking about the first century church, the early church, the earliest Christians, the Jews and the Gentiles and the Romans and the women and the slaves and the soldiers and the educated and the wealthy. But he's also, ultimately, he's talking about us, because we believe because of the disciples' teachings. They went out and they spread this message. And if you trace the generations, we're here now because of what they said, what they did. So Jesus is praying for you and I in this moment. It's not just for them alone, but for all of those who will believe through their message. That all of them, Jesus is praying for us today, that we would be one, that we would have unity, that we would be unified. He goes on, he says, I've given them the glory that you gave me, that they may be one as we are one, I in them and you in me, so that they may be brought to complete unity. Then the world will know that you sent me and have loved them even as you have loved me. That's crazy, right? I mean, you can think about a lot of things that the early church did, a lot of the ways that they lived and acted and loved and included, and the boundaries that they crossed, and how revolutionary so much of it was when they acted out what Jesus told them to do. But as Jesus is praying, he's praying for us that we would have unity so that the world would know. it's not that we would have skills or that we would have, he doesn't even really pray specifically for the impact of how we can care for our communities. He's praying for unity. Because as we are unified, there is this reality of what begins to happen around us. As we're unified, we're able to do some incredible things in our communities around the world. As we're unified, we're able to show a beautiful picture of who this God is. So Jesus prays that we would have unity so that the world would know who God is and that God loves them. Jesus could have prayed about an endless number of things these hours before his arrest and crucifixion, but ultimately he chooses unity and oneness. I wonder if he knew something that we should know. I wonder if there's something important about this idea, this message. I want to be clear, this does not mean that we all agree on everything, as you probably can assume. I bet there's as many different perspectives as there are people in the room. Unity is not utopia. It is not like this green field where we get to frolic around and everything is perfect. It's hard work. And difference is inevitable, but division is a choice. We get to choose if we want to be divided from other people. We get to choose if I want to cut these people out of my life because of their political beliefs. We get to choose how we are going to act, and maybe most importantly, react to what people say and do and what's happening around us. Differences are inevitable, and it's okay. And it's not that every single perspective and belief is the right one, but there is this reality that we have to become aware that we are learning and growing and changing and flawed and broken and hopeful, and ideally we're being transformed by God's love. Differences are inevitable. But division is a choice, and it is not one we are supposed to pick. The enemy of the church, the enemy of Christianity, it's not another political party, it's not people in another political party. The enemy of the church is division. And as Christians, we have to be willing to choose people over politics and unity over political parties. It doesn't mean that we don't engage, but we engage in a way that reflects the unity that Jesus prayed that you and I would have. It's not something that we get to opt out of. In John chapter 13, again, Jesus is talking. He says, "So I give you a new command," not a new suggestion, by the way, "a new command, love each other deeply and fully. Remember the ways that I have loved you. And demonstrate your love for others in those same ways. Everyone will know you as my followers if you demonstrate your love to others." Not conceptually understand love, not talk about God's love, but literally the command is to love others. And we don't get to define what it looks like. Jesus told us what it looks like. It looks like the ways that I've loved you. Do that. Continue doing that. I heard one pastor say, we can choose to follow Jesus, but we do not get to choose what following Jesus looks like and sounds like. That has been prescribed for us. That has been articulated for us. There's a way that it should look and sound when we follow Jesus. So practically, what does it look like for us to pursue unity towards others, and specifically towards Christians? I think one of the things that I'm beginning to hear more and more, one of the things that I've said in the past, I'm guilty of this too, is how can you be a Christian and vote that way? How can you be a Christian and support that candidate? How can you be a Christian and be okay with this policy? And we begin to strip away who they are in Christ because of their political leanings or voting history. What does it look like for us to recognize that there are differences and there are challenges? But division is a choice. How can we avoid the political powder keg in our relationships? I want to suggest a few things. And again, I have three things I want to suggest. And I think that All three of these actually can apply regardless of where you're at in your faith journey, but these are deeply rooted also in our faith as Jesus followers. The first one is humility. I think if we're able to move towards humility, it'll be an incredibly important thing for us. It's an important way for us to begin pursuing unity in our relationships when we show up with humility. Now, when you try and talk about what is humility, it can be a bit nebulous. A lot of people, they feel like it's, well, humility is kind of like letting yourself get walked all over. I've heard some people say that humility isn't thinking less of yourself, but it's thinking of yourself less. These are all good definitions, but there's something that I learned about a few months ago, and it's called epistemic humility. You guys may already be smart enough to know what this is, but epistemic humility is a specific type of humility. It's grounded in the realization that our knowledge is always provisional and incomplete, and that it might require revision in light of new evidence. And then somebody broke it down this way, which I think is so great. Instead of always trying to be right, what if we just try to be less wrong? It feels like a bar that I might even be able to hit. I might be able to make it that far. And so rather than just us be like, okay, I'm going to try and become a more humble person. I'm going to pray that God will help me become a like, what would it look like for us to actually engage in relationships without the need to be right, but with the posture of, you know what, there's things that I don't know, and I would like to continue learning. I would like to continue growing. I'd like to continue understanding. And yes, this has to do with politics and these kind of conversations of what's actually happening, but also this has to do with your marriage. This has to do with your relationship with your kids. This has to do with your faith. When we approach things with this clear sense of humility as, I believe that I don't know everything perfectly and yet. There's an option for us to learn and stay connected to the people around us. To say, I'm going to choose to continue to learn from you. And learning from you does not mean that I necessarily agree with you or even that I change my perspective. But it creates a way to humanize other people that we have turned into villains. In addition to general knowledge, we need to remember that we are broken people, deeply loved and being transformed, but we are still broken. And in our pride, we villainize other people and parties, and we forget Jesus' teaching in Matthew 7, where he talked about, why do you point out the speck in another person's eye when there's a log in your own? There's a sense of recognizing, man, like, I can't believe they're doing that. But also, I bet I'm doing some crazy things too. I bet I have signed on to some things that I didn't fully understand. I bet I have chosen to associate myself with some people or some policies or some things that I didn't actually read the fine print. I literally signed another contract for a rental this week for this like phone party that we're having after service. And I just scrolled through the entire contract and signed the bottom. And you've all done the same thing. We don't know what it is that we're signing on to. We're not always reading the fine print. And the reality is for us that spiritually we were taught to focus on our own brokenness, our own need for grace, our own need for transformation. We like to be able to focus on the bad guys, and we like to forget that there's a brokenness in us. There's a quote by someone, I'm not going to be able to pronounce his name, so I'm not going to try. But he said, if only there were evil people somewhere insidiously committing evil deeds, and it were necessary only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them. But the line dividing good and evil cuts through the heart of every human being. It is impossible for us to just somehow do away with the bad people. This is a question when I've had people talk about this idea and ask questions about why doesn't God just like, you know, do away with the evil? Well, because it's me. I'm also evil, and it's you. And so if God were just to do away with all evil, then there would be no us. The line between good and evil goes directly through our hearts. Every one of us carries this brokenness, and we contribute to the brokenness around us, even as we are continuing to be transformed by God's love and learn and grow in different ways. So the first one is humility. The second one is perspective. We need to have humility. We need to have perspective. There's this law. It's kind of like a statement. I can't remember the guy's name. I want to say it was Miles. Miles Law, I think, is what it's called. I should have written that down, huh? It says, where you stand depends on where you sit. It has to do with this idea of where you stand in issues and topics and conversations. It has a lot to do with where you sit. It has to do with what your perspective is. Your cultural context is where you sit, and it oftentimes determines, or it is the lens that we choose. What are the issues I want to stand on? What are the issues I want to make a case for? What are the things, what's my perspective on these different topics and conversations? I've talked a lot before about my love for art and creativity, and there's these things, they're called anamorphic illusions. And here's an example of one, and don't go ahead yet, Gavin. So, beautiful stairwell, hallway. It's got this kind of bizarre-looking red entryway. Well, as you walk closer towards the stairwell, we can go to the next slide, you realize it was painted in a way that it makes no sense. When you're on it, when you're in it, when you're coming at it from an angle, just for good effect, let's go back to the last one. I know you guys are like, wait a second. It's crazy. It's crazy how this, you could be 3 inches off of center, and it makes no sense. It seems like chaos and pointless. But from the correct perspective, it's beautiful. There's a couple other examples. Here's another one. Again, it's like, okay, that's bizarre. Did they make that on a computer? But then in the next slide, if you look at it from a different angle, like this is the way they painted that hallway. And then there's another video of it that we can leave just kind of playing for a minute as I talk. The perspective that we have is shaped by so many things. Where we live, our family of origin, our education, our experiences in life, our careers, your personal lived experience is primary in shaping how you view various policies. Where you are from, what you have been shaped by, all of these things, they shape your perspective. One of the things that should be shaping each of our perspectives is our faith. We should be using that as our primary lens, even over our family of origin, the country that we're from, the job that we have. We should be using our faith as a primary lens for how we navigate conversations and connect with others, and how we use our vote or our political power in any moment. It's also worth noting that most political positions aren't really matters of, as Tim Keller says, they're not matters of biblical command, but practical wisdom. Meaning, there could be a biblical command for us to care for the poor. And there's maybe 1,000 different ways that we can care for the poor. And depending on your perspective, you probably are pretty passionate about how we care for the poor. The command, biblically, is for us to do this. And so we do this, and we navigate this conversation in a lot of different ways, a lot of different approaches. There's different perspectives on this, because where you stand depends on where you sit. And the third thing, so the first is humility, the second is perspective, the third one is proximity. The proximity that we have to others. There's an African proverb that says, from afar, it's a monster. From a distance, it's an animal. From close, it's a person. Face to face, it's my brother. And some of you guys are like, yeah, I have this. I need readers to make it through a day. I can't tell what's happening at any given moment. But there is this reality for us of the proximity, the relationship, the connection, the time that we spend with people. We remember that they are loved, they're good, they are kind, they are worth love and value and respect. And the farther that we are from people, the easier it is to villainize and demonize and cut them off and just assume that they're crazy, that they're stupid, that they're evil, whatever these things are. The proximity that we have, and this is one of the primary reasons why being a part of a church is so important, and being a part of a church that's different is so important because it causes us to spend time with each other, to be around each other, to remember that people in our circles, in our neighborhoods, in our communities are good people. We've become in our culture really comfortable with dehumanizing others. There's a Stanford study that was done over the last couple years, and here's what they said. While social norms have made disparaging behavior and derogatory language towards other races, genders, and religions unacceptable, there are no corresponding pressures to moderate disapproval of political opponents. In fact, the rhetoric and the behavior of party leaders suggest to voters that it's perfectly acceptable to treat opponents with disdain. In this sense, individuals have greater freedom to discriminate against out-of-party supporters. Simply stated, politics is the one place where it feels like it's okay to talk about someone as poorly as you want. Like there is somehow freedom to say whatever you are thinking. The dark and evil thoughts that we pretend to not have, somehow we have made it okay to say that in the political realm. Not only is it often accepted, sometimes it's viewed as patriotic. And a lot of the news that we consume to stay informed of what's happening, it doesn't help us see people the way that Jesus sees them. It helps us see them as evil problems to be taken care of. I don't think it's correct to view people with political differences as our enemies, but even if that were the case, it seems like we've forgotten what Jesus said about our enemies. In Matthew 5, so he's talking about one of the primary marks of his kingdom and what it looks like for us to live in his kingdom. He says, "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father. He causes the sun to rise on the evil and the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." And that's frustrating, right? I can't imagine I'm the only one that has wondered why it has to be that way. But Jesus is teaching, this is what it looks like to live in my kingdom. It's not to hate your enemies, it's actually to love them and to pray for the people that persecute you. And that's what it looks like to be children of your Father in heaven. And so I don't think that other political parties and perspectives actually are our enemies, but even if they were, we're not off the hook of treating them how we want. The proximity that we have with others is crucial. If someone considers you their enemy, you are not required to return the favor. You may be their enemy, but if you're a Christian, they are not your enemy. We don't fight against a physical enemy, but against the powers and principalities of the world. There's a spiritual battle that's happening. I know that it can be really easy to, well, let me take that back. It's not easy to preach about this. It can be easy to sometimes just talk about things and have these as like lofty ideas. But there's actually a story of a couple guys in our church over the last 6 years that have been on this journey of navigating a really tense relationship. I want you guys to hear this story. It's a powerful one. They're from our campus here. They are deeply loved and a part of this community. And as you watch this story, I want to invite you to consider if you notice the themes of humility, of proximity, and perspective. Just see if those themes show up in their conversation. But let's check out this story together.
My name is Rick, and I'm a.
My name's Ed, and I'm a. I'm very set in my ways when it comes to certain things.
We did have very different opinions, and we are very strongly willed people and are very strongly verbal about how we feel about certain subjects.
I may be right, I may be wrong, but I'm very passionate about things.
We really butted heads a lot of times on that. Sometimes almost came to blows a couple times.
I want to say it was Easter Sunday.
I think it was. Oh, my goodness.
Because we were wearing hats, and you threw a hat at me, and I threw it back. that particular Sunday, service was over and we had stepped outside into the courtyard and we started talking about a particular topic that quickly escalated into quite a heated discussion. From there, it came to the point where if either he or I didn't literally take a step back, it would have been taking a step forward for a very different reason. I stormed off, he stormed off. Our wives were like, what in the world is going on? I remember saying, he's not welcome in my house ever. Never again is he welcome in my house.
Like I said, if I didn't walk away, we might have thrown blows. And like I said, in retrospect, it's so silly to think about, but I think it's on both of our parts, it's this indignation that how dare you don't agree with my opinion that has to be the only possible truth.
So moving forward from that particular Sunday, it was a struggle, but we're married to two sisters that love each other very much. So it was a little unfair and challenging for them, and I'm sure very tense. And I think at that particular time, it wasn't taking much for either Rick or I to blow the top.
I was very disrespectful, and I didn't realize it at the time because I was being too busy being right. Ed was the one who extended the olive branch, and the fact that he was willing to do that really touched me.
For me, or where I started to see things a little bit differently, was the fact that I couldn't divorce him, right? We're family, and you're not going to avoid family your whole life. I mean, I guess you could, but that's really no way to live. So we started to try to find things that were a little bit more common ground.
We went and saw Kiss together. And that was the beginning of the mending of our relationship. And I took responsibility for my part, and he did the same. And we realized that it's just not anything worth fighting over.
It made life easier for everybody, for Rick and I, but for the entire family as well. I mean, you don't realize how much you're affecting an entire group of people when you're so into your political beliefs.
Was during a church sermon that it really convicted my heart that particular day for some reason. God is like, love your neighbor like yourself. Not if he has the same political views as you. Love everyone regardless of whatever their beliefs are. I've never been so convicted that those relationships are so far more important than your belief in a political party.
I'll be the first one to say that this has been one heck of a road trip. Right, that we've been on, and it's one that didn't start out well at all, but I think that we understood that regardless of how we feel politically, our tie both as Christians and as family members is more important and has more value than any political side of anything that we could talk about or disagree with.
I've come to learn and accept that I love you as a brother, and family is way more important than any disagreement we can have over some stupid political issue. And I think something else we've come to realize too, and I think is a great part of our relationship, is we need each other.
Yeah, we do. We're married to sisters.
We're married to sisters. So we become good allies despite our differences politically. And I think that's a great thing. And like I said, regardless of how you feel about things politically, I've come to respect you and love you as a brother.
Love those guys, and I love that story. I think it's a beautiful picture of a journey that is still going. It's not perfectly figured out, and I know there's going to be tensions for them, just the way that there's tensions for you and your friends and your family members. But there is this invitation for us, and especially if you are a Jesus follower, you don't get to opt out of how you pursue, care, love, reach out to your brothers and your sisters in Christ. We should be treating everyone this way. But Jesus prayed for unity. The most Christ-like thing that you could do this week might be to pray for unity between you and other people that you know that vote differently, but follow Jesus. We cannot continue to allow politics to divide us because there is too much at stake. The more unalike that we are, the more reason we have to dislike one another, the legitimate reasons and the non-legitimate reasons we have to dislike each other, to avoid each other, to criticize each other, they are all opportunities. Unity is critical because it authenticates our message. When we are able to say we are different, but we are not divided, it authenticates what we claim to be true. It is the proof in the pudding, if you will, that we serve a God who is changing our hearts, that we follow Jesus and we live differently, that while everyone else is happy to sling mud and to talk bad and to criticize and to point the fingers at, we get the opportunity to be unified around the most important thing and to view everything else through that lens, through the lens of our faith. And it authenticates what we claim to be true, that God is loving and is inviting everyone to experience hope and transformation, and that I am experiencing that too. Unity is what proves that. Differences are inevitable, but division is a choice. So we're going to wrap up in just a second here. The practical action step that I have, do we get that slide in the computer, the action step for the week? I don't know if we did or not, but the question that I want you to think about this week, to take note of, is, do you feel more camaraderie with people who share your faith or agree with your politics? I think this is the thing that I want you just to think about this week as you notice who you're following on social media, as you notice the people that you're closest with, as you notice the conversations that you have. What is the primary identity marker for you? What is the tribe that you feel most drawn to? And as we pay attention to that tension, it's important for us to ask the question, what does it mean? What do I do with this reality? I think that the best way for us to end this service is to be reminded of who all sat at Jesus's table. I think when we take communion together, it's an opportunity for us to be reminded of who it is that Jesus is inviting to follow him. In just a minute, we're going to have an opportunity to sing one last song and take communion together. And in case I forget, I want us, when you are released to get the communion, I want you to bring it back to your seats. We're going to take it all together today. But at the Last Supper, just a few hours before Jesus prayed this prayer, it was right after Jesus washed the feet of the disciples. They're all sitting around a table. Matthew was a tax collector. He was a Jewish man who worked for the Romans to take money from his own countrymen. People hated tax collectors. They were seen as traitors and opportunists. He was sitting at the table with Jesus. Simon, who oftentimes is called Simon the Zealot, and it's not just because he was generally passionate about things. He was a part of a kind of anti-political movement that was basically trying to overthrow Rome at all times. Essentially a freedom fighter against Rome, was sitting at a table with Matthew. Peter, who would come to ultimately deny Jesus. Judas, who was the one who would betray Jesus. And many others, full of all kinds of differences. They were all sitting at this table together. Jesus washed each one of their feet. And then he broke bread with them. And he invited them to continue to do this in remembrance of him. To continue to take this step. To continue to take this action. To take these sacraments, these elements. To remember that moment that choice, that decision. And I think for us today, oftentimes communion can be this thing that we do because we've always done it, or we grew up in a church that did it often, or there's all kinds of different reasons and perspectives, and it can just kind of become a little bit meaningless. But today, I want us to take communion remembering that first table and who was there, who Jesus sat with and included and loved, regardless of their political perspective, regardless of their failures that were soon to come, the betrayal that was right around the corner. We are invited to emulate this reality. Well, regardless of where you may be at in your faith journey, I believe that everyone has a next step that they can take. If you'd like more information about what it means to put your trust in Jesus, information about getting baptized, or maybe even attending a Discover class to grow more in your faith, you can visit us online at southhills.org/Costa Mesa, and then scroll down to the Next Steps section. If you'd like more information about tithing or supporting South Hills financially, you can visit southhills.org/giving. Thanks again for listening today, and I hope that I get to see you soon.